So I'd like to start with one of His Holiness the Dalai Lama's quotes in his book Advice on Dying. And he said, really, what ruins our precious human rebirth and keeps us circling in samsara is the attitude of permanence, the attitude of self-cherishing. And really, that's what does it. And therefore, he said, if you really want the most, therefore, if you understand that, then the most valuable meditations to do in, when you're approaching dying is those of impermanence, emptiness, and compassion. And if you study a little bit on impermanence, when you come to look at emptiness, that would be so helpful to you. So helpful, really. So I spent some time on impermanence because really it's the key. It is the key to however you discuss it. This is the key. Okay. Now, I want you to think about maybe a time you were in company or the last time anyone was talking about death. And you might, it must have been a few, you must have happened a few times. What do you think the prevailing attitude is? I mean, there's different attitudes. What type of attitude do you get when people are confronted or talking about death? What are the prevailing attitudes?
People feel very uncomfortable about it.
Very uncomfortable, yeah. I think it's changing. I'm personally thinking, I mean, I know it's we say it is uncomfortable and people don't like to talk about it. And that is true, but I've noticed over the last few years a far more willingness for people to talk about it than ever before. However, still there's this overhanging attitude. That makes people feel very uncomfortable.
Especially if they're ill. I've, it seems so. People who are talking to the person who's maybe terminally ill, they don't quite know how to make a kind of easy conversation.
No. No. Everybody finds that difficult. Doctors find it very difficult. They usually leave it to the nurses. And some nurses are better than others. What other attitudes do people have? When they hear, you know, when you're talking about death.
Humor.
Humor, yeah. Sometimes people just go, oh, yeah. You know. Why?
Dismiss.
Yeah.
It's easy to dismiss.
And that's the attitude, is it? It can be, there's quite a lot of people I've come across very dismissive. I don't want to talk about that. We all know we're going to die. Why are you banging on about it? You know, it's going to happen. Right? This kind of very, almost flippant, almost dismissive attitude. There's a lot of people like that. A lot. What else? What other type of attitudes come up?
I've heard it when I've been in conversation that a younger person was horrified that we were talking about death and said we had morbid curiosity.
Yes, morbid curiosity. And you just know that came from an older person, really, don't you? You just know that.
That's
she's heard
from
that
the
somewhere.
Person.
Yeah, but she's yeah. heard. They've heard it somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, why are you being so morbid?
Yeah.
You Buddhists, all you talk about is death. Yeah. What other attitudes come up? Because if we talk about how to help ourselves and to help others, we need to be really. This has to be up front and centre in our minds. We've got to know how people are responding. So it's good to know the major types of responses. I mean, you already know it. It's just bringing it up. What other type of responses?
It's denial and some people who are facing death.
Denial, yes. Yes. And that becomes quite interesting. That becomes quite interesting. And if you've got, certainly when I worked in hospices before, you would never push the idea that somebody was dying. But you very rarely come across someone that doesn't know. I mean, you've got fourth-stage cancer and you're in a hospice. I mean, spot the clues. But still, there are people there who quite openly speak about their death, or death generally, before they get into their death, and others won't. And if you've got some counselling skills, you can usually tell how much people want to know. For instance, you have a conversation with someone, and you must know this, and they say something like, I'm going to get better, aren't I, nurse? Now, what nurse is going to turn around and say, well, I don't think so, dear, I think you're on your way out? They're not going to do that. They're not going to do that. So how you respond to that, often the way people, especially if they're extremely ill or they're dying, often if you listen to the way they formulate a question, gives you the way to answer. By the way, I'm not saying to lie. I'm saying just be careful. Be careful what you say. Because you can get another person that says something like, I don't think I'm doing very well, nurse. I think, kind of, this is it. What do you think? And you're going to turn around and say, no, you've got plenty of time yet. You know, that's what their family's probably saying to them. Hang on till Christmas, you know. Hang on to the birth of little baby son so-and-so, you know. That's what they're doing. So listening to how people word a question is kind of useful. It's kind of useful.
Also anger.
Yes, yes. All the emotions come up. Anger, tears, fear. Definitely. And you have to know how to deal with that. And I'm not sure the Dharma teaches that. That's something that in the West we're very good at dealing with, or we should be, because there's enough education out there where you can learn counselling. This is where you bring counselling skill, life skills into it, isn't it? So this dismissive attitude, this anger attitude, what it tends to be, I think, is people pushing the idea of death somewhere far into the future. It's kind of, yeah, I know I'm going to die, kind of just not yet. It's pushing it quite far in the future. Because if you push something far into the future, then you don't have to deal with it now. And you get a lot of that. And a lot of full stops. I know I'm going to die, I don't care, I don't want to talk about it. Is that the type of person you would pursue with knowledge on death? How would you help that person if that person's not asking for your help?
You might just sit with them.
It's possible.
There's a lot, I think, just in being present with someone dying.
Can help?
Can help? If they don't want to talk about it.
Mm. So the whole idea here is it's really important not to disturb the person's mind. If you can do nothing else, if you can do nothing else, you make sure, if, as much as possible, that the person's mind's not disturbed.
Because you don't want to clutter them up with ideas, just from it.
The time to learn is when you're well, fit and healthy. The time to learn something new is not when you're dying, or even not when you're ill. Really. When you're ill, people keep coming up to you and say, have you tried this and have you tried that? Have you, you know, this Reiki and this, and you're sort of going, this break, you know. This is not the time, really, often. Unless it's asked for, it's often not the time. You need to learn this now, when you're relatively fit and healthy. Your mind is uncluttered. It's not the time when people are dying.
There's a kind of bafflement, isn't there, as well, around death? It, because of being a culture where it isn't really accepted.
Well, it's seen, often seen as a failure.
Exactly, yes.
Unless you're very old or you're old, then people are quite happy with it. Yeah.
But it's also not a specific religious view that is prevalent in the whole culture. So
yeah. If
someone has a religious view, sometimes that baffles people.
It's true. Unless you make your wishes clear beforehand,
yeah,
then it's quite interesting what people want to do.
People don't quite.
Yeah. No.
So you have to do that. That's part of the owning, I suppose.
I know, but really, I've been on a lot of anybody here been on multi-faith forums? Anything like
people
that?
People ignore them. I mean, I've been in places where people look at these living wills and they don't necessarily,
yeah,
you know, they can't,
yeah,
follow it.
But often there's not a lot to do.
No.
I mean, really, in different types of religion, often there isn't much to do, really, except get the priest, get the vicar. They do the prayers and, you know, you've been good, you know, you'll end up in heaven. You know, things like that. There actually is very little. In the Dharma, there's a whole load. There's an awful lot you can do if you're asked.
Yeah.
What about if people are frightened?
What about if people are frightened?
When they're dying.
What about them?
Would you just sit with them if they were like that?
Yeah, I think you're talking about life skills here. I don't think you're talking about anything. I mean, is it me? But the Dharma has things to teach. But people in the West have got things to bring. And counselling skills, empathy, all of that is never wasted. It's never wasted. So wonderful to bring in. And even if this person's not that interested in learning things and doing things and they just want to die, then really the bottom line is do your best, whatever it takes, to make that person peaceful. That's the main thing, to make that person peaceful. But let's bring this back to us now. It is interesting in death, when you're doing death meditations and death retreats, is often, I said to you right at the beginning, the discussion is dragged to others. And we have to ask ourselves, I know we're nice people. We wouldn't be sitting here if we weren't nice. We are bodhisattvas in waiting. That's what we are. Well, some of you might be bodhisattvas already, I don't know. But really, we're very nice people, aren't we? And so it feels okay always to bring in, how do I do this for others? But really, it's about what we can do for ourselves. Learn through getting ourselves ready. You can learn in tandem, certainly. But we need to get ourselves ready. That seems reasonable, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And it's all about stepping out of the illusion of permanence into the reality of impermanence. That's really what it's about. You must have noticed, if you've ever seen His Holiness the Dalai Lama give teachings, either by video or you've been there, as he climbs up to the throne, before he sits down, he snaps his fingers. Anybody notice that? He always does that. Watch for it the next time. They're going up, not just His Holiness, all the higher lamas do. They're climbing up to the throne. Just before they sit down, snap their fingers. And really, that's what this is about. Impermanence and emptiness. Impermanence and emptiness. Whatever goes on, impermanence and emptiness. Before they sit down on the throne. That's how important this is.
Is it just to
remind them? Yes.
Not to be proud or...
Well, that comes into it.
Mm.
I mean, if you understand impermanence, why would you be proud? There'd be nothing to be proud of.
Yeah.
If you understand emptiness, it's a nonsense.
Mm. But all the time I've seen His Holiness speak, when he got up to the stage, he saw some cords where they shouldn't be, and he went down and started picking them up and moving them.
Mm. Oh, he likes to do that. Wearing dark glasses and baseball bat cap to front, yes. It's always interesting, that. But permanence, impermanence. So with this stepping out of the illusion of permanence into the reality of impermanence, the next step in owning your own death within, you know, the Buddha's idea is what's called the mindfulness of the 9-point death meditation. Within this 9-point death meditation, I know people who run courses and this is all they do, time after time after time. So have a quick look at this.
Thank you.
What we meditate on time after time in order to make our death a reality, our death, my death. Each of these points you can spend a whole meditation session on. So it's called 9-point and 3 roots. So look at the first root. The whole impetus on this is death is certain. And you can't approach this meditation going, yeah, well, yeah, so, no. Our death is definite, nothing can prevent it. Now, we don't believe this. Because not understanding impermanence properly, you know, subtle impermanence, we put a lot of time, effort and money, which, you know, nothing wrong with it, but it's not going to do the full job, into external things to prevent us getting ill, to prolong our life. Yes? This healer, that healer, whatever. Because we don't get this point. Our death is definite and nothing can prevent it. Can you imagine how you would behave if that became a reality in your mind? Our lifespan cannot increase. It continuously decreases. Being really aware of that. Being really aware. Now here's, you know, here's where you don't start getting depressed about it. Here you remind yourself why you're doing this. You're doing this to get the energy to go and do something about it. Owning it. Saying this is absolutely true. There's no hiding here. It continuously decreases. Death will come regardless or not whether we've had time to practice Dharma. Regardless. The time of death is uncertain. Our lifespan is uncertain. I mean, how real do we hold that in our hearts? Our lifespan is uncertain. Honestly, I've sat down on this chair, there is no certainty I stand up again. None. But we seem to think there is. Things that can kill us are many. The things that can keep us alive are few. In this meditation, you sit and you go through the types of things that can kill you. Personally, I think of getting up in the morning. From that moment, and I imagine a day, everything I interact with, the people I interact with, the weather, the implement, everything. All of these have the possibility of killing you. Even the medication we take for our health can kill you. Do we really live this life knowing the multitude of stuff out there? We are so fragile, we don't think we are. We get a taste of it as we get older. You get a taste of it if you have a serious illness. But you tend to forget it if you get better. You're dicing with death between each in-breath and each out-breath. And we don't know it. This meditation makes sure that you know it. So going on to route three, only Dharma helps at the time of death. No money or possessions can help. It doesn't matter, does it, how much we have? I mean, really. I mean, we can make ourselves a wee bit more comfortable, but it's not going to stop us dying. Friends and family, these people who have helped you and have been there with you, you know these people, yeah? Your friends, your family, who have helped you since you were born. As we get older, they all die off. All the older ones die off. So you're left with friends. Your friends who will do anything for you, right? Go to the ends of the earth for you if you're lucky to have such friends. They can't help. And in fact, friends and family can end up being the worst thing that can happen to you as you're dying. Especially if you want to die in a particular way. Because if it's not the way they think you should die, a lot of conflict. A lot of conflict can come. A lot. It wouldn't be, I mean, many times looking after dying people and having relatives squabbling in the corridor within earshot of the patient. And I'm not saying once or twice, I'm talking many, many times. Many times. Come on, dear, you can do better. You just have to just take another deep breath. If you've not seen it, really, what a tableau. So those who have sustained you in your life end up, or can end up, being the worst thing that could happen to you as you're dying. Not even our own body can help us at this time. We have relied on our body all the way through. We've pampered it, we've looked after it, we've soothed it, we've clothed it in the best things we can, best stuff, nice shoes, everything done nicely, yeah? And it's helped us out. it's helped us out. It's been kind of good to us. As we got older, maybe had one or two illnesses, but still. But in the end, and I'm not talking your last breath, I'm talking a bit before you die, quite a bit before you die, nothing. Your digestive system won't work properly. Incontinence will be your neighbour, or it could be. Breathing will be difficult. Touching can be very, very sensitive to you. Your skin will break down easily because of what's happening within the body. Your whole body will turn against you. It just will. Everything we rely on, all of it, will turn against us. Now again, remember, this is not to make you depressed. It's to say, wait a minute, of course it will. That's the impermanent nature of this. I have to own it. I need to know what's going on. But you need to get your mind in that state. And that means exploring each of these points, each of them. So you're going to break into three groups again. So this group, I want you to discuss the first route. Death is certain. This three, I want you to discuss route two. The time of death is uncertain. And this group, the only Dharma can help at the time of death. Okay? Now, take each, within these routes, take each of these points. Don't just gloss over it. Really look what that actually means to me. Okay? Yes. So please start. And only then will we do a meditation on it. You see, if you discuss this now, bring it up from the depth, really go into it, when you do the meditation, it will be rich. Do you understand?
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, the meditation is not rich. So discuss just each of the roots I've given you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Can I just open the window a little bit?
Please. It might be useful for each person to take the lead on one of the points. Not to talk all the way through, but to take the lead. It might be helpful so that everybody gets a chance. Yeah? So, each group had one route to concentrate on. And this whole room, all nine routes were looked at, which is quite good. So when we have feedback now, just be aware that you're sharing with other people as well. Okay, it's not a teaching session, but just what came up when you looked at route one. So those of you who have not done route one, just have a quick look there. Death is definite, nothing can prevent it. Our lifespan cannot increase, it continuously decreases, and death will come regardless whether or not we've made time to practice Dharma. What type of thing came up in your discussion?
Well, it's quite definite, really, that first part.
Yes. But it's that nothing can prevent it.
Nothing can prevent it, but we did go off a bit on a tangent.
Oh, did
on
you?
Cryogenics.
On what, dear?
Cryogenics.
Cryogenics, okay, yes.
And then we thought then whether the consciousness was still attached to that body, depending on how quickly they did whatever they do to the body to prepare it for cryogenics. And therefore, would the mind still be all that conscious?
I have no idea.
Well, no, this is why I say
we digress
a little bit.
Absolutely, who knows?
Yeah.
Absolutely, who knows? Can you imagine doing that? I mean,
oh, and you know, and the thing is, what happens if the consciousness has gone, which it probably has? And so you're left with a brain, and perhaps, you know, the body can be revitalised.
Well, my fear is the other way around. What if the consciousness is still there?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah.
Somebody turned the heating up.
Yeah.
I don't. Yeah, no, I have no idea.
Yeah.
Honestly, no idea. But this is—I mean—it's the pinnacle of trying, of denying that nothing.
Denying and nothing can put it off. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. You see, here, obviously, for the individual that's contemplating this, and people have put... There's a young girl won a court case recently, didn't she? Was it an American girl? One young girl won a court case. She was dying to be actually put into cryogenics.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was fairly recent. Yeah.
I think that's more a fear of death, isn't it?
Well, it's all about that. It's all about fear.
Yeah.
And also, really not understanding impermanence, not understanding or having any kind of clue about mind,
exactly,
or even reincarnation. People who hear about reincarnation who've not studied or even read about it, they think that people like that because it gives them another chance, or you just like that because it's another chance. Most people who understand reincarnation don't want to do it, thank you, because they see it for what it is. But that doesn't deny it happens. But imagine if you believe that this is the last bit. Well, maybe if I believed there was, if I didn't have a wee bit of understanding of mind and reincarnation, people would do that if they had the money.
Mm.
It's all this. What? How can I prevent death?
Yeah.
How can I prevent death? What else came up?
You couldn't really argue with any of the points.
No, that's the problem with this, though.
Yeah.
It's because all of the points you can't argue with.
No.
And so we tend to gloss over. It's about making it your own, saying, how does it fit with me, really?
So it sort of came down to more, how would I live differently if I really was thinking about this when I got up in the morning, or... when I'm at work and I get sucked into a stressful situation, or when I visit my family, if I really was thinking these things, how would I be different?
How would you be different?
I would be very different. I would be... I would be much more in the moment, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I would treasure things and people a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just, the stress of certain things in my workplace, just which I claim I'm going to stay detached from, but still will get affected,
mm-hmm.
I'll just be, probably just see it exactly for what it is, instead of,
mm-hmm.
What must be happening is my mind must get confused, because I think...
Well, you've had lifetime after lifetime of denying all this, so,
yeah.
I mean, no wonder.
Yeah.
You have to rehabituate yourself. A lot of what we have to do is deconstruct the ignorance that we have in our mind and reconstruct it with wisdom. Really, that's what we have to do. And that deconstruction can be quite painful. How would it change your attitude towards others? Not what would your attitude towards others.
Mm.
Would it change it? Apart from not buying into their, angst.
Well, hopefully it would make me more compassionate if I knew that, if I truly knew,
yes,
that we are all in the same
exact
condition.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's said that this is one of the best ways, one of the very good ways to actually develop compassion.
Mm-hmm.
That it's not, you suddenly wake up to the fact that everybody's going through this. Everybody. Some of them don't know it, some of them will just ignore it, some will push it away, but really, they're in the same boat as you, suffering in exactly the same way as you.
Mm.
But you've got a bit of insight. I think the compassion would definitely go.
Mm.
I think it would definitely go. Because it would be hard to be angry in that situation, it would be hard to be jealous. It would be hard to be greedy in that type of situation.
Mm.
Very hard. You start to kind of, I wish them joy of that. May they be happy. That idea kind of can come almost, spring almost spontaneous to your mind. At the moment we do it in prayers, eh?
Mm.
But really, if you grasp onto this, really grasp onto this, and you look at other people, realising they're in exactly the same boat. So when something happens that's positive in their life, you rejoice in it.
Mm.
And there's not a lot of rejoicing goes on in this life. We just don't do it.
No.
Well, I'm very happy for you. Yeah, right. A lot of people are not happy for other people when they're in a good space.
Mm.
Or, I really think that's wonderful. I really rejoice. And then you're waiting for the caveat. Of course, she's got the money for it, something. It's almost some sort of edge. when this grows in your mind, there really is no edge. That's what it says. Anything else?
Yeah, Kelly did the
second.
Well, so it's all you know, right? Okay.
yeah, I have a painful death. I'm a Dharma practitioner, but I have a painful death.
Right.
It's sudden and it's painful.
Right.
I'm in a horrific accident.
Right.
Would I then have time in the bardo state, the 49 days, at some stage to then purify the mind to still have a human rebirth? Or
it really depends on your karma. It really does. And how much you've been practicing. If you've been practicing in a tantric way and you recognise you're in the bardo, you may have a chance. But fear and the suddenness of it can be so shocking to the mind, it's said. Very hard to control. I remember one of the first teachings I had on this, I was asking very similar questions. Because I had this idea, now that I knew about it, you know, no problem, eh? I'll just control it. And this nun was there, and she said to me, "So you think you can control it?" I said, "Oh, absolutely." She said, "Do you drink?" I said, "I do." She says, "What do you drink?" And then I met a long time ago. I said, "Vodka." She says, "Well, imagine. You've got an IV drip going into your veins, pure vodka. After 2 minutes, how much control would you have?" I said, "Not a lot." She said, "No." So she equated being in the bardo with being so confused, so frightened. It wasn't the I was coming from the point of view saying, "Oh, I'm in the bardo, that's good, okay, so there's nothing to be worried about. Nothing to be, anything that comes at me that's very fearful, I'll just take it as aspects of the Buddha, no problem, you know. I'll forget this colour and I'll go towards that colour. I'll remember bodhicitta, because that's kind of the main thing. And I won't grasp at anything." So then it all worked out. I thought, no problem. You know? And she's looking at me like this going, "Really?" So I think it really depends on your practice. And so, but there's things you can do, though. I mean, purifying negative karma that may cause you to have a sudden death. This is where purification becomes very important. See, when this becomes clear in your mind, certain things happen, and you kind of, from this moment onwards, this is how I'm going to act. This is how I'm going to be. I'm going to be absolutely careful that I don't sow any seeds that cause me to do this. And if you've taken refuge, and why wouldn't you? If this was your path, why wouldn't you? Then there's a huge blessing in that, huge purification in that. It purifies a lot of negative karma. Then looking back, when you weren't so aware, you purify the past. You purify past karma. You find the strongest practice you can get, you get yourself a retreat, and you really go for it. Lama Yeshe had all his students do a minimum of 3 months. If you went to him to say, "Well, I'm going to say this," and he goes, "Yes, dear, yes." 3 month Vajrasattva, off you go. You know, all his students did 3 months Vajrasattva. You know, and that was his answer. So of course you do. You did 3 months Vajrasattva. That's what you did. To kind of purify. So there's things you can do now to purify that type of thing. Absolutely. And if you've got strong refuge, if you've got strong refuge in your heart, it doesn't matter what the pain is. Practice now. Practice now. The minute you know how painful a paper cut can be, right? Mm-hmm. Our first thing, isn't it? Nobody's got a paper cut like this. And you're looking around for plaster. Imagine if your first response was taking refuge in your guru. Imagine if your first response was, "You know, I've got this pain. I bet a lot of people in this world have got pain worse than this. May I suffer on their behalf?" What if your first response was taking and giving on the breath? Then going to look for your plaster. Imagine practicing that now.
That makes a lot of sense.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It really does.
Yeah.
Then you start to own. So yes, these things can happen. For sure they can happen. And sometimes pain can be so dreadful it blows everything out of your mind. It can't. It just can't. But practice now with little pain. I'm not saying don't treat your pain. Of course treat your pain. But on the way to getting a plaster, on the way to getting your medication, painkillers or whatever, on your way to seeing the doctor, take strong refuge. Don't expect it to cure the pain, although sometimes it does, but make that your first port of call, along with bodhicitta. If you have refuge in bodhicitta, in the bardo, nothing can harm you. Nothing. Good point. Okay, route two. Time of death is uncertain. Our life plan is uncertain. That's important, eh? Because it doesn't matter that we know that, you know, children die before whatever, you know, young before old, and all of it, doesn't matter. We still think, don't we, that older people will die first. So, and a definition of older people is 10 to 15 years older than you are now. Remember that. When you're a child and you look at somebody 10 years older than you, they're old. They're old. When you're in your teens and somebody's in their 20s or early 30s, God, they're ancient. You're in your 30s and somebody's in their, I don't know, late 40s, they're ancient. Research is showing that people defined, well, this was old research done in the 90s, but still, people defined old age as being 10 to 15 years older than they are. How many times do you hear, you know, 60s and you 40? Really?
Wow.
60s and you 40. That's what they say. 70s and you 50. I'm going up 20 years, eh? Okay. You don't know. You honestly don't know. Things that can kill us are many. Things that can keep us alive are few. When you think, just think of the things in this world that could actually keep you alive if you were ill or if you were dying. What is there around that would actually keep you alive? And then think of all the things that could kill you. Really. Then what? The stupidest things can do it. I tell a story of a friend of mine who decided to have an obsession. She decided, that type of personality, she decided to obsess on seahorses. She saw a documentary and she decided that she would focus on becoming a master diver. So she'd then go to, I think it was the Seychelles or somewhere, and she could dive to save seahorses. It took her 5 years. And she was working full time. She ran a hospital. And she worked, I mean, but it became, she was very obsessive personality anyway, so she had like seahorses all over her house. A seahorse on the handle of a cup. A seahorse toilet holder. I mean, seahorse mobiles. You name it. It was a seahorse, you know. And she worked, she learned to swim, she learned to dive, she became a master diver, blah, blah, blah. She had everything ready. And they still wouldn't take her because on this particular thing she saw, because she was too old by then. She hadn't put factored in her age. She was probably one of the fittest people there. So she found an alternative place that would take her for diving. On her first diving holiday, first diving that she went down when she was out abroad, she went down alive, came up dead. First one. When they autopsied her, they said she was the healthiest corpse they'd ever seen. She was healthy. But she died. She took everything with her on this holiday because she told me she was meant to be coming to stay with me when she came back from this holiday. And I went to see her. And she had one of these people that laid everything out for the holiday. You know what I mean? And she had a wetsuit and flippers. Everything was laid out. And I said, "You're taking all that with you?" She says, "Yes." She says, "The only thing is," she says, "you're not allowed to take an oxygen canister onto the plane. So I'm going to have to use their oxygen canister. And to be honest, Mary, they're not very good, those ones." I said, "Oh, I never thought anything else about it." Turned out it was the oxygen canister that killed her. It was a faulty valve. You don't know. You just do not know. Going out in, what was it, the last great storm we had in the UK, 86, that big storm?
Mm-hmm.
All the buses were shot to bits, you couldn't get on the bus. I had to walk into work, and I was walking against, you know, really terrible. You don't remember that storm, it was just amazing. But I was working at the hospital, so we got in, and I was manning the phones. And there should be somebody sitting next to me 10 years younger than me, and she'd said, I'll come in and help you because, you know, you need some help. She was killed on the way into the hospital by a roof slate. Came off the roof and killed her. You just don't know. And we're shocked by it. We're just shocked by it. That shouldn't happen. Why? Why? If we really understood this, why? And yet that's what we do. And it's not just sorrow for the other patient or the other person. It's shock. Why? It's because we really haven't understood this. It's got nothing. I'm not even not talking about compassion. I'm not talking about, you know, being sad for other people. Being sad is quite normal. I mean, that's... But it's the shock. And inside we're thinking, it shouldn't have happened. She was too young. She was too vibrant. She was too healthy. It was a freak accident. I tell you, these freak accidents, so many of them. So many of them. Do we really know that? Things that can kill us are many. And the things that can keep us alive are very few. And this one, in general, our body is extremely fragile. Well, when you're young, you don't really believe that. As you get older, maybe. But look how sick you can become, and look how incapacitated we can become so easily when we're sick. And one period of sickness makes you vulnerable to another period of sickness. It weakens you. And as you get older, worse. And if you have a long-term illness underneath that, it doesn't take much to make you really ill. But we're okay, aren't we? Because we can get antibiotics, oh really? They're not very efficacious at the moment, the antibiotics. Even the last line of defence of antibiotics now have got resistance. You know this, don't you?
Yeah.
And the drug companies, they're not putting any money into research for new antibiotics. The government's trying to get them to do that. They say this is the next great disaster waiting to happen. Ordinary infection. Things that we read of in the old days, people used to die of, pneumonia, things like this. It's coming up again. All of that's happening again. People are seeing rickets now in hospital. People are seeing vibrant TB. And they've not got, I mean, there are drugs, but they're having to use the last line of defence drugs almost immediately. But hospital's safe, isn't it? Be okay, you can go to hospital. No. However hard they work in a hospital, it's a very dangerous place to be.
Certainly is.
And I'm not just talking MRSA. I'm talking about tired doctors who have been on for a day and a half. I'm talking about nurses who have not stopped the entire day and having to do a double shift because somebody hasn't come in. Never mind getting the wrong drugs. Never mind getting... I mean, I could go on. But what are you ending up with here? You're ending up with a fact that really, very fragile. We need to become aware of that. Really fragile. But again, not to get depressed. Just to wake up a bit. Just wake up. Yes, I know. People say, and this is the stage where you say to yourself, and I really wanted to come on a weekend to hear this. This is where this comes up now. Okay, anything else from Route 2?
We were Route 3.
We were Group 2.
So who was I speaking to before? Who was the last person I was speaking to? Did we not go to Group 2? Oh, well, let's go to Group 2. Anything come out of that?
No,
have we done that?
We were group two.
I'm so sorry. Really? Yeah. Old age has taken away my memory. It's taken away my memory and given me osteoporosis. It's not a fair exchange.
I suppose there was a few things, you know, obviously you'll say all these things you can't really argue with. And, you know, regarding the uncertainty, you were saying that sort of makes you sort of appreciate life and to use time meaningfully.
Yes.
You know, obviously practicing Dharma is, you know, extremely, maybe the most meaningful way to do that, and helps you focus that, and maybe focus appreciation on relationships and things like that. You have.
But it's good to have relationships. It's good to have friends. Mm. All of, there's nothing wrong with all this. Really.
Mm.
But practicing Dharma becomes prime. But you can practice Dharma with your friends without advertising the fact. In fact, you need your friends.
Mm.
You need living human beings around you. You need them. If it wasn't for human beings, you would never become enlightened. You need sentient beings. You need animals. You need insects. You need people.
I suppose what we're saying is focus on appreciation of those people in our lives.
Yeah,
and even, especially the people that annoy you. They're really valuable. No, really, these are valuable, valuable people. You will learn no Dharma, or very little Dharma, from people that like you. They just agree with your idea of who you are. But have someone that irritates you a bit, causes you a bit of annoyance. This is the person where you learn to practice love, compassion, patience, generosity with your time and effort. They become extremely valuable. When we say practice Dharma, yes, meditation, but I'm not talking about just that. The time you spend in meditation is a fraction in relation to the time you spend with other people. So it impinges on how you spend time with other people. Not just what you do, but how you do it. Anything else?
We were talking as well about taking risks and things.
Mm-hmm.
If one realises and one knows that these things say that many things can kill you and like the body is extremely fragile and the world is quite a dangerous place really. But you remain part of it.
I know, you do.
Mm.
But as you get older you take more care, eh?
Mm.
When I think of the... I mean, you must have when you were younger, I don't know, but took a lot of risks, a lot more risks than you do now.
Down. Should we take risks? Because you do when you're young, don't you?
It's when you're young, because you don't believe anything's going to happen to you. I cannot believe the risk, the war zones I was in. Mm.
But you can't say to the young, don't, can you?
Well, nobody could say it to me.
No.
If that's what I wanted to do, that's what you wanted to do.
Yeah, exactly. Mm.
You can't put an old head on young shoulders.
No.
Can't do it. You just have to hope you survive.
Mm.
My father used to say to me, Mary, I used to pray every day you survive. Because of the tussles I used to get into here and abroad. Okay. Anything else?
You have to apply wisdom to that, don't you? And sort of balance. Because you know, we were saying about certain risks which people worry about now. So we were saying we have these terrorist attacks and things like that. And you know, from going back and... We all worry about it and we want to put ourselves in situations, but statistically, it's probably the least thing you should worry about. You know, and there's a lot of places which we may perceive, or things we may perceive as dangerous to do, but actually there are far more dangerous things, like having a shower in the morning. It's probably safe, more important to be mindful when you're in the shower, because you could slip over or walking down the stairs, you know.
I think you make choices, eh? You make choices. If this life... This is where understanding the preciousness of human life becomes important in the Lam Rim. This is why when you study the Lam Rim, I don't know if you've ever studied the Lam Rim. If you've not, it's good to do. That's why you start off with precious human rebirth. You start off understanding the preciousness of this life. But... I think even if I was... When I was very younger... And I knew that I would still do what I did because there's something about being young and wanting to travel. What can you do? Personally, I think you just hope to survive. I mean, I may be wrong. I mean, I'm not. This is no great wisdom. It's just how I feel, really. Because life can be very boring unless you take some risks. For goodness' sake, dear Lord, you got to take some risks. And if it's meaningful to you, go for it. But then you own what happens. You don't gripe about it. If it goes wrong, you own it. Anything else? No?
I don't even know how to ask it. But it's something about karma. If your karma is set, then if your karma is set, then you could do anything you wanted.
Could you?
I don't know. I'm just thinking. Some people. But there's an idea I've got from somewhere that there is a possibility that your story is already written.
All right.
And that unless you're very mindful and practiced in being aware of that, you can't do anything about that.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Yes. Just something I've heard. I just wondered if there's any kind of overlap in any of that sort of thinking with karma.
Certainly if you've created the causes, again this is putting into karma, which is a whole different thing, but if the seeds are on your mind, put it this way, if you've got negative karma on your mind, and when that karma meets up with similar causes and conditions, it will cause that karma to ripen, right. And you suffer the effects.
So you could have a feeling for that.
It's possible. But personally, we've lived countless lives. Mm. Think of everything negative that you could have done. Just assume you've done it. Mm. That's what I think. Not just this lifetime, many lifetimes. I just assume I've done everything. But you can purify negative karma. And sometimes if your purification is strong, you can completely purify it. Sometimes you can weaken it so that it ripens fairly quickly, but it ripens much milder. Because karma multiplies, you see, it actually grows. Karma's not static. But you do have choices. You do have choices in what to do. But karma is very powerful. It's what drives. But it's not written in stone. Certainly not. You can work with that. But you have to work with it. Understand karma as much as you can. Watch what you're doing from now onwards so you're not creating any more with body, speech and mind. And purify the past. Purify it. And you'll see signs that it's being purified. You'll get the signs to when that happens. But if you're saying, this has happened because of something I've done, I think that's reasonable.
Mm.
That's reasonable. It's nobody else's fault. Who else are you going to blame? It was all my mother's fault, my father's fault, my friend's fault, the person who drove the bus, blah, blah, blah.
And sometimes you have a sense of, have called it a sixth sense. Sometimes you have a sense of something and you decide not to do it. Or
it's possible. People do that.
Mm. And where does that fit into?
No, well, some people just have, their mind is a wee bit more refined. And some people are born with certain abilities, not just physical abilities, but mental abilities. And their intuition is often right. Not always, but often. And how many times have we had an intuition not to do something, haven't done it, and it's been a load of nonsense? We don't remember that. We only remember the incidents where you didn't do something because your instinct told you not to do it and it worked. But many times our instincts are not right. They're not. But we remember the times when they are right. But that's not to say that people aren't born with certain abilities. Of course. Of course. Anything else? Okay. I've got this right. Group 3. So, only Dharma can help us at the time of death. No money, possessions, friends and family, or our body. What came out of your discussion with that?
I think you've covered a lot of it, really.
Well, it's basically that if you truly, truly believe that you are going to die, then you will concentrate on Dharma in all shapes and forms, whether it's just as you're living normally, or you would then, but also really getting to know about the death process and being able to recognise it and all that sort of thing.
Well, what about money and possessions? They're quite helpful.
Well, they can help. I mean, we also talked about those first two being could be helpful. So money and possessions can make you more comfortable.
To a certain stage.
To a certain stage, yeah.
In death. After that stage, makes no difference.
Yeah. And we talked about friends and family, didn't we?
We said, actually, I think, that at the time of death, those things don't help.
At the time of death.
At the time of it.
When we go through the process, you'll see why.
Yeah, that's something that's we talked about there, didn't we? That,
yeah. Yeah, at the actual time of death.
At the actual time of death.
And I just know, I'm reminded of a nun who died about 2012, and she was quite wealthy. She gave a lot of her money away, gave a lot of money to this place as well. And she sponsored myself to do a retreat, and she sponsored another nun to do a retreat. And she got a private place in a hospice, and you know, she put the money that she had left, that she'd given away, so she made herself as comfortable as possible. But I remember her saying to me, it's going to help me at the moment, right at the moment, but when I'm dying, it'll make no difference. So she was well aware of that. And friends and family?
Well, we talked about practical things that could possibly, friends and family could be helpful if you had made clear to them already your wishes, and so therefore they would be supportive of whatever you were doing. And we talked about maybe the idea of, I think I've heard of death buddies, where you've actually nominate somebody who will be contacted to actually help you through the prayers and practices. And
to a certain
like
stage.
To a certain stage, again, then, to a certain
and
stage.
And then no stage. And unless they've been well primed, often more of a hindrance.
Yeah.
I mean, I still have a vision when I worked in intensive care at the Hammersmith of a 16-year-old girl who died, lupus. And her mother threw herself on the bed. We could not get her off that bed. The girl was dying, right? I mean, she was nearly gone. And the mother literally threw herself on top to hold on. You know, I often thought, I was glad that the child was at the stage she was at, because I don't think she would have noticed that aspect. But if she hadn't been at that stage, I think that would have been dreadful for the person who was dying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I see people clutching at relatives, patting their head or touching their arm or rubbing their feet, and you know, all, you know, just total distraction. And if you're trying to practice Dharma with the type of death, this is very distracting, really distracting. That's what you don't want. But the thing about people is when they're in a situation like a death room, they want to be physically doing something. They'll fight each other to clean the person's mouth. No, let me do it. No, I want to do it. They're desperate to do something. If you're in that situation, really direct them to do things that are not actually to touch the patient if it's possible. You know.
On that last one, it touched, didn't it, on what was being said about the first one, about pain.
We certainly talked about how bad, I mean, we talked about not just things like you talked about, like incontinence and stuff like that, but if your body really turns against you, like some of the like motor neuron disease and stuff like that, and how do you cope with that, and would you want to commit suicide? Would you want assisted euthanasia, you know? And I know from listening to Lama Zopa that would be the last thing that you would be wanting to do according to Dharma. But it would be very hard. I mean, even to watch if we've got a pet, a dog suffering, you take your dog to the vet by and large, but apparently that's not what you should do because you're...
Well, we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
We'll definitely
so
talk about
that. All of that sort of stuff came up when we were talking about that. But Jen, basically, I think one of the things we also said was what you're living just now is your past karma. So what you're trying to do in this life is to create lots of positive karma. Because this is all a waste of time, as you said, unless you believe that you're going forward somewhere.
Mm, that's right.
So you're creating positive karma, purifying the negative, and really getting to know the process so that you can do the best you can.
And you can. I mean, you can. I mean, there's purification practices, no problem. But actually, and that's good to do, absolutely good to do. In fact, every night, really, if you're sensible, every night. But also you can do in your response. See, think about pain and suffering, especially chronic conditions, is our response tends to be very negative. Oh, the pain. And then your friends don't help. Oh, how are you feeling today? You know, I think, oh. You know, and you say, oh, I'm fine. Oh, but you always say that. You're going, oh, dear Lord, stop. The reason I think like that is because how you respond to a ripening negative karma is very important so that that particular negative karma doesn't keep going. Do you understand? If there's something in your life that's kind of happens to you quite often, there are some people who always get stolen from, for instance. There are some people who always lose things. There are some people who always get sick. You know what I mean? They go on always. You know, there's things that happen to us that are, that's obviously deep-seated karma. When these things happen, and personally I think anything negative happens, your first response is important. Because if you can counteract that with something so diametrically opposite, then you can stop that karma from not there and then, but stop it growing more. See, this is the problem with karma. So, it's your karma to be, I don't know, fall down and break your leg, right? How do you deal with that? In that moment, how do you deal with it? Because if you deal with it with an ordinary mind, then I think you're creating the cause for this to happen again. Do you understand? If you can deal it with a Dharma mind, even slightly, you've got a chance of halting that. Yes, you have to suffer it now, but I can stop it now. So how we respond to negative things happening in our life, I think is very important. Doing the purification practice, obviously, but how we respond when things go wrong, physically, mentally, environmentally, it's very, very important. And I don't mean that you lie. Oh, it's so going to be okay. No, not like that. But understanding, this was my karma. I created the cause of this. I better make sure that my response is reasonable so this doesn't continue. I think there's quite a few ways to deal with this.
Is that like, not turning it into suffering, into more suffering.
Yes.
But acknowledging that it's happening.
Acknowledging it's happening. Acknowledging your... I mean, you don't have to sit down going, right, I broke my leg, so I must have... You know, not, it's not that way, but it's no. That's behind it, yes. Because the origin of suffering is within suffering itself.
Yes, that you don't... But you can have an attitude that makes yes.
you
suffering rather than
how
you
thing. Suffer becomes important. Becomes, I think, becomes very important. Because suffering begets more suffering in this life and in future lives. Because the origin of suffering itself is within suffering. It's nowhere else. It's not external to it. This noble truth is very, very important to understand. And if you put it, if you say, well, that is clear, then it's clear how I've got to respond. Also how you respond to positive things. Not just the negative, how you respond to the positive things. You start deconstructing our own way, old ways of doing it. Because feeling sorry for yourself or blaming others, particularly blaming others, it's dangerous because why? Because superficially it may be. They may have some fault. And then everybody around you starts saying things like, you're quite right. I saw them.
Yeah.
Do you know that's not the first time they've done it? So you build each other up with it, you know, and it becomes hard and fast on your mind. And it will ripen again.
Because they're the conditions,
yes.
aren't they? The
yes.
Thing to...
So, can I just ask about how you, when you respond to when things go wrong? Because I think, suddenly forgotten your name, I'm so sorry.
Me?
Yes.
Margaret.
Margaret was saying yesterday that she'd read somewhere that whatever happens to you,
or
whoever comes into your life, if they're annoying you or hurting you, you think this is exactly what I need. So I don't know if that's the
think
same
of
kind
them.
Of thing.
I remembered it. I think it's fine.
So you kind
think
of
think of anything that happens, anything anyone does as fulfilling your wishes.
That's handy.
Yes.
Yeah, so no, that's thought transformation.
It's fulfilling my
so,
wishes. So
yes.
You actually, even though you know, you don't want to go into denial about if you really are feeling irritated, but underneath that, you can be grateful.
Yes.
Is that the way to sort of transform it?
I think that's reasonable.
Gratitude?
Don't you think?
Yeah.
I think that's very reasonable. Because we think we can be enlightened and we can do all of this if we're just surrounded by like-minded people.
Yeah.
People who love me. People who see me for what I am. You know, this wonderful individual. No. Where'd you learn patience? Where'd you learn gratitude?
Mm.
Where'd you learn generosity? You don't learn it from... You learn it from the wide variety of sentient beings around you.
But it's just so natural, though. It feels, rather... It, you know, if there's some... If you have, like, a circle of friends and there's one person who doesn't treat you well or... You don't really want to spend time with that person.
Yeah, but that's reasonable. If you can't transform that, then move away from it.
Right.
Of course.
Yeah.
Don't force yourself into a situation where you're going to be irritated with it.
Mm.
Have the tools of the trade ready. And practice. Just practice. Even if you're there for 2 minutes. And then, oh my Lord, is that the time? You don't have to lie. Is that the time? Well, actually, yes, it is the time. There you go. Maybe next time you can give 3 minutes. Or maybe you're in a bad mood one day and you couldn't even give 1 minute, so avoid it.
Yeah.
Don't. You're not a punching bag. You're not a punch bag. You've got a precious human rebirth. And these people are a valuable resource if you know how to use it. But if you're in the state of mind where that's not possible, then it's best to move away. Of course. Yes. Okay. So you're going to have a break now, and when you come back, we're going to do a meditation on this. See, there's something to look forward to, right? So please take 20 minutes to have something to drink, a bit of fresh air, because this next meditation can be a wee bit... This is the stage where you're going, oh, not death again. Okay. But we're going to do this whole meditation now. Okay? Please.